Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is Lauren Stubley, who was on just a little while ago, and he wrote a book about the 1940 election. So, Larry, plug your book.
Hello, Cynthia. Thank you again for having me on Focus on Albany. Mm-hmm. And the book's title is New York Station. And it was published earlier this year mm-hmm. by Blackstone Publishing. A lot of people who listen to audiobooks are probably familiar with Blackstone because they're the largest audiobook publisher in North America. And now they have this great print division. So it came out, and I'm told it's doing very well. And it's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of interest, because the part of the background and much of the text of the story is the very little-known Nazi effort to rig the 1940 presidential election. They made quite an effort. They sent over $5 million, which is a lot of money, a hell of a lot of money in 1940 to do it. And and they did a lot of different things. So it's eerily relevant to a lot of things that's been going on in the world for the last couple of years, and appear to still be going on with the Russian interference in elections all over the world, and including here in the United States.
Well, right now, the Russian interference is kind of like at the back burner. Everybody's attention is, you know, with the Kavanaugh nomination. So overall, what do you think what are your views about Brett Kavanaugh being nominated and voted into the Supreme Court?
Well, I think there's reasons why the Republicans are pushing this man so hard. I mean, they certainly have plenty of conservative jurists who by any reasonable sense, whether one agrees with them or not, are well qualified. I mean, if you go back a number of months to last year, I mean, after all, where was the fuss over Neil Gorsuch? I mean, he went through quite easily because he didn't have all the incredible amount of baggage that Brett Kavanaugh has. I mean, this sort of drunken frat boy who seems to have all kinds of issues with women. I mean, it's very strange and it's very troubling. Excuse me. But I think there's a reason why Trump and the Republicans do want him so badly. Part of it's because they're staring down the calendar. Basically, all the senators want to get out of Washington as quickly as possible and go home and campaign, at least the ones that are up for election. And the House, after all, has already recessed, so they're all back in the districts. So they're looking at a rather daunting calendar if they're going to nominate someone. They're going to be out for the election. They'll come back in November for a couple of weeks before they break for Thanksgiving. Then they'll be back for a week or two in December, and then they're done. And there'll be a new Congress in January, and they don't know, you know, there's no way of knowing who's going to control the Congress in January, although all the polls seem to be looking very, very good for the Republicans. So they had a very limited time frame to sort of ram this man through. Second half of that is why are they so intense on having him? I think a lot of this is about the Gamble case, which is coming up soon in the Supreme Court. Now, what that is a lawsuit that's been filed over a case, I believe, in Louisiana. And it basically concerns what's called the double jeopardy issue. Now, presently, under federal law, the way it's been structured for really most of the country's history, you can be prosecuted for an extremely similar crime in both federal courts and state courts. And this violates the double jeopardy clause of the Constitution. Now, as a practical matter, this almost never happens, or it's virtually never happened, that you'd be prosecuted for the same court, same crime in both federal and state courts. But let's say hypothetically the Gamble case wins and basically the separation is dissolved. Right now, Trump and his associates, in the media sense, are very threatened by all kinds of corruption charges that are being brought in the state of New York and also in the Southern District of New York, Federal Southern District of New York, and in the city of New York for all kinds of crimes and malfeasance. I mean, the New York Times just did a very big, massive series, almost the size of a book, on Trump's family's corruption. I mean, Trump evaded paying taxes on $418 million worth of money that he basically was given by his father. And they've been running money around in and out of rabbit holes all over the place. And, and, they're in a lot of trouble on all these charges. I mean, Trump is not a self-made man, contrary to what he says, but there's all kinds of illegalities were involved in this, so they may be at legal jeopardy. They're also at great legal jeopardy over the Russian collusion investigation that Bob Mueller is conducting. So there's a lot involved, but let's take the immediate issue here with the state things. If the Gamble case is overthrown, Trump can as things stand right now, Trump and his family and his associates could be tried in the New York courts, in the New York City courts, for various crimes. Trump cannot pardon any state crimes. He can only pardon federal crimes. Now, if the double jeopardy case goes down and Gamble wins the case, basically that will be unified. So the president would suddenly then have the ability to pardon both federal and state crimes. So he could pardon himself, he could pardon his family, he could pardon all the people who are involved in all these crooked business dealings that he appears to have had over a very, very long time, almost 40 years. Although, of course, statute of limitations applies in a lot of cases. So a lot of people are really afraid that if Trump got this pardon power, he'd be able to basically, it's like playing Monopoly and having a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's kind of a dangerous kind of thing. I think Congress at some point is going to have to clean this all up with new legislation. The president should only be able to pardon federal crimes. He shouldn't be able to pardon state crimes. The president has never had the power to pardon state crimes, but he may acquire that in the future, depending on how the Gamble case goes. Kavanaugh has made it clear he's probably going to rule on the Gamble case, basically in Trump's favor, so that Trump would have this expanded pardon power. So people were really afraid of Trump having this kind of power. As the situation stands right now, for instance, to go back to Mueller and the Russian collusion investigation, if Trump and his associates were involved in collusion with Russia, even if Trump shuts down that investigation, the New York Attorney General's office could still prosecute Trump for all sorts of crimes involved with that. But if the Gamble case goes away, then suddenly he can pardon everybody, get off your jail card, basically, like Monopoly. Now, to expand that circle out a little bit more, you may recall that, according to many news stories, and I think it's been widely conceded, it's true, in the fall of 2016, the Obama administration became aware that Russia was interfering in the election, and they were getting all kinds of warnings from the intelligence community and also from foreign intelligence communities. It was not just the United States that was involved in this. And Obama went down to Capitol Hill and talked to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and said, we need a joint statement. We can't have foreign interference in our election. McConnell completely blew him off, told Obama that he would basically attack Obama, that he would charge Obama was trying to rig the election, that they were trying to basically, he would just totally turn around, and Obama backed down. Now, mm-hmm. I know a lot of people love Barack Obama. I love Barack Obama. But that was his failure to basically stand up to Mitch McConnell was a terrible mistake. Maybe it's probably arguably the worst mistake he ever made. And it's hard to think of a worse mistake than any president made. I mean, it's like Marlowe did when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Did FDR go down to Capitol Hill and say, excuse me, do I have your backing? He said, no. You know, this is a day in infamy. We have to fight back. There's just no question about that. The president's obligation under the Constitution to defend the country from attack are not impinged in any way by any kind of congressional action. That is his duty and responsibility as a commander-in-chief to defend the country if it's attacked, period. And he doesn't need congressional authority to do that. So that's a strange sort of episode. Now, why, the question to back it up some more, expand the circle a little bit more, why did Mitch McConnell do that? Well, there's good reason to believe that a lot of the Republicans were also involved, along with Trump. Were the Republicans using basically the Russian intelligence service to do opposition research for them? Were the Russians interfering online, doing all sorts of things against attacking various congressional candidates? There's good reason to believe they did. We're all focused on the Trump-Clinton race. But Russian interference wasn't limited simply to the presidential race. They were interfering also in congressional races. How much did Congress know about this? This we don't know. Mueller apparently is investigating this. So it's possible there are a whole number of Republican legislators and other Republican officials who were involved, possibly, in the conspiracy with Trump and with the Russians to interfere in the United States election. And they were basically encouraging, as Trump did himself during the election, you know, if you've got Hillary Mead's mail, let us see them. You know, he actually urged the Russians to hack Clinton's emails. And were other Republicans involved in this kind of hacking effort? Oh, we don't know. For instance, when the Russians broke into the servers of the DNC, who got that information? You know, did it get shared with other Republican officials and not just with the Trump campaign, as it's sometimes alleged? So I think there's a lot of stuff out there we don't know. It's still unraveling. It's really kind of scary and dangerous. And, you know, this whole issue of foreign interference in our elections is a very troubling one. And I think it's something we're going to be hearing a lot more for many years to come. And I think that's actually, to take it back if you don't mind, a little plug here in a sense, but take it back to my book. It's, you know, the Nazis did interfere in the 1940 presidential election, at least they tried to. I think as long as democracies exist, there's always going to be a danger of people trying to attack a nation through its electoral system. And I think we here in the United States have been very complacent about this for a very long time. And I think we need to increase our awareness of the danger of that. We need to build election systems that are absolutely uncrackable. It can't be hacked. It can't be interfered with in any way. There are a lot of people who are urging that we should have nothing but hand-marked paper ballots that are manually counted. The Dutch, for instance, originally had voting machines. They've gone back to paper ballots, hand-marked, manually counted, in public. So uh-huh. Everyone can see what's going on. Well, so you want a completely transparent process. Even here in New York State, we mostly use hand-marked paper ballots that are machine-counted. But even those machines uh-huh. represent an element of opacity. They're not, you know, who programs the ballot counting machines? Could the ballot counting machines be hacked? I mean, you see, they do spot check. Every time there's an election, they go through and they spot check the machines, they spot check the paper ballots, but they don't count them all after the election is over. More or less, the ballot counting machine, the tape that comes out of the ballot counting machine is the ballot. It's you know, not the ballots themselves ultimately in the end, and they don't even save them in most states. So, you know, we need a system. We need a system that's always going to be a threat, and we have to look for more secure ways to secure our elections. If we do go with electronic systems, there have been some people in the computer industry who have suggested blockchain, what's called blockchain technology, where a new tag is applied to each ballot so that nothing could be interfered with it. But that's kind of hypothetical and kind of out there, but it's just like a hand-marked paper ballot. It seems like an awfully simple thing. It comes in public where everybody can see it. And maybe we need to think about that some more. But certainly I think the big question coming with the 2018 elections is, are we going to be attacked again by the Russians? Or Trump, of course, is talking now about the Chinese. Who knows if that's for real or not. But it could happen again. So this is all very scary stuff.
Now, let me ask you this question. You were just mentioning a case that's supposed to go before the Supreme Court.
The Gamble case.
And
right.
Yes. And you know, it has implications for Trump and the
mm-hmm.
Trump family.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
The implications for Trump, would you say that all of the stuff that might come out, all of it happened in New York State?
A very great deal of it happened in New York State, yes. I mean, Trump is a legal resident of the state of New York. His companies are chartered in the state of New York. Most of his investments and properties are a very large percent in the state of New York. There's great exposure here in the state of New York. There's no question about that. And the New York Attorney General, both Attorney General Underwood at the present moment and the new Attorney General who will be elected next month, whoever that may be, presumably it's going to be Trish James, although you know, we don't know that officially, but you know, certainly she's massively ahead in every poll, so I think it's safe to assume it is going to be Trish James. They're going to have a big they got a big job on their hands, and just investigating it alone, because the whole thing is so large. And it's fortunate that the New York Attorney General has a big staff, and it's also fortunate that Governor Cuomo is strongly behind the Attorney General's office on all of these matters, and is very strong on all these issues involving Trump.
Now, Trump has been involved in New York State politics for a number of years. And,
oh, yes.
You know, he was a Democrat at one point.
Mm-hmm.
So because he was involved in New York State politics, all his actions were not done behind the scenes. People within the power structure must have known about his shady dealings. Would you say that was correct?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much. I think he's always had a fairly sleazy reputation. But then, you know, the real estate business in New York City can be a fairly sleazy affair in a lot of ways, and it's not.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, but he was there, and but he was a big developer, and he made a lot of projects happen. I think it was mysterious where all the financing came from. We may have a better picture now where that did come from. A lot of it was through tax fraud, and you know, he held on to money that he should have been paying in taxes. I mean, if he got $418 million from his father, he should have paid somewhere on the order of $225 million worth of taxes, which is a lot of money by any standard. So, I mean, it was, you know, how if you look at it that way, I mean, Trump Enterprises would be vastly reduced if he had to pay those. He'd be bankrupt. He'd be bankrupt because his Atlantic City casinos failed. And it's an interesting question how you lose money on a gambling casino, but he found a way to do it, apparently. You know, I don't know how, you know, it's sort of an odd thing of a casino failing financially when all you do is sort of stand there all day and take people's money.
So, you know, today is Saturday the 6th, correct? And the vote
is
supposed to happen tonight, this evening, for, you know, to confirm Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court.
Yes, it's probably going to happen.
What do you think? If he is elevated to justice, what do you think is going to happen within the state? Will there be riots? Do you think people will be complacent? What's your view?
Oh, I don't think there are going to be any riots. Not at all. I don't think we're going to see anything like that, but I think we're going to see an enormous increase in energy, political energy, going into the campaign, because I think people are just, women in particular, are just so outraged, and it's basically, it's this. Senator Gillibrand's been saying that they're telling women their lives don't matter. So I think for a lot of women, it's just enormously personal, and they're a lot more enraged, and it's particularly damaging to the Republicans, because their victories in recent years have been dependent on white suburban women, and I think because of this, they've lost white suburban women in good measure. Obviously, a lot of non-college educated white women, they've been with Trump all along. Some people are saying the Democrats are losing non-college white women. Well, the problem with that, and that's a threat to the Democratic Party, the problem with that logic is that the Democrats never really had those non-college white women, or non-college white people generally, working people generally. They never had them in the first place. That's the white populist vote. The group that they depended on and went back and forth was white suburban women in particular. And I think they've lost that for a generation or more. It's that vote is pretty much gone. So I think they're in a really, really bad place. And I think Trump sort of screwed the Republican Party, really the first whiff of trouble with Kavanaugh. He should have pulled his name and sent him one of a number of qualified and conventional conservative justices who probably would have sailed through very quickly. But now they've sort of blown the whole thing up, and they're sort of in a horns of a dilemma, because if they do pass him through, they enrage a whole enormous block of voters upon whom they are very dependent, and whom Trump himself was very dependent. If it doesn't pass, well, a lot of evangelicals have threatened to walk away. For instance, Franklin Graham, that's Billy Graham's son, who was a major evangelical leader. Basically, he made a proclamation 2 or 3 weeks ago that if they didn't ram the Kavanaugh nomination through, that he and a lot of other evangelicals would just walk away from the Republican Party, that it wasn't worth bothering to support them. So they're sort of caught in the horns of dilemma. If they don't, you know, basically if they push it through, they lose white women. If they don't push it through, they lose evangelicals. It's a lose-lose all the way around for them. And I think that and what's probably going to happen now is they're going to lose white suburban women, but it won't necessarily, because they won and their base isn't mad now, those people aren't particularly motivated to go out and vote, and they don't have a strong voting history in off-year elections anyway. A lot of those Trump voters who showed up in 2016 are what in politics we call 4-by-1 voters. A 4-by-4 voter is a voter who votes every single year, very reliable. A 4-by-2 is a voter who votes in congressional races, and a 4-by-1 is a voter who only votes in presidentials. A lot of non-college-educated voters generally tend to be 4-by-1s. Not exclusively, not all the time, but they as a group, they tend to be more towards 4-to-1s. So if those groups, if they're not mad and they're not upset like they were in 2016, they don't tend to show up at the polls. So victory in an election isn't exclusively based on who shows up, but if you think about the mathematics of it, it's equally based on who does not show up. So if Democrats are very energized and, certain blocks of Republican voters are sort of either fat and happy or just not particularly concerned, they're not going to show up as much. And that's very bad for them all the way around. I think it's from the polls, it looks pretty obvious that the Republicans are going to lose control of the House. I even think a lot of races. I live in Glens Falls, New York. I'm in the 21st Congressional District. I think even there, the Republican representative, Lee Stefanik, is in a lot of trouble, and very bad. It's looking very bad. But she may lose. We'll see. But she may be beaten by Tedra Cobb, who's running an extremely strong campaign. It's really quite interesting. But if you put this all across the country, there's going to be a big Democratic pickup in the House. The question now is what's going to happen in the Senate. And I think they may have jeopardized because of this tremendous dependency on white educated suburban women, because they've lost this huge block. There are a bunch of Senate seats on the Republican side that are now in jeopardy that they thought were safe. So it's going to be an interesting night on the 6th of November to see what happens with all of this. I think we can expect to see big gains for Democrats all over the country, particularly for women who are running for office. I think we're going to see record numbers of women elected for all kinds of office. Also, I would note there are a lot of women running for gubernatorial offices for the first time, and I expect we're going to see a lot of seats there flip, and they're going to be flipped mainly by women candidates.
You know, I read a while back that the Republicans concentrate on state elections, state legislature elections, because it's the state legislature that carves out the districts for Congress. So even though you say, oh, there might be a blue wave and stuff, but if enough Republicans went in state houses and they win a majority in state houses, well, they could redraw the map to ensure that the Republicans will be back
Absolutely.
As the dominant party of Congress. And people don't realize that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think it's a real danger. I think you're exactly right that the Democrats have not adequately focused on down ballot races. And there's sort of a lot of this goes back to the beginning of the Obama years when we controlled most state legislative seats, but the under Rahm Emanuel took over the DNC and they focused just on a small number of top down races. And the DNC. And they were busy picking winners and losers. As soon as when Howard Dean was the DNC chair back in the early aughts, He said, we need to run everywhere. We need to have a 50-state strategy. That was abandoned during the Obama years under Rahm Emanuel's leadership of the Democratic Party. And they got into this whole thing of picking winners and losers. And it was a disastrously wrong decision. It's very fortunate, I think, for the Democratic Party that he's not going to run again as mayor of Chicago. He's out, basically. And I think we need that whole thinking gone. We need a 50-state strategy. The Democrats need to run everywhere at every level. I think we actually are seeing this. I think it's happening somewhat more spontaneously, but it is happening. I think we're going to see a big emphasis in elections, particularly in 2020, on taking back a lot of these legislative seats and also governor's mansions. I would note that's why a lot of these gubernatorial races this year are so important, because the governors can veto these gerrymandering plans. That I believe just happened in Virginia. The Republicans in Virginia have an extremely small lead in the legislature. It's like only one or two votes or something. But the Governor Norham did, I believe it was Governor Norham, did veto a redistricting plan. So that shows how it can be done if you just have a one person in the right place, and they can go back and they can renegotiate that and get a fairer, more neutral plan. But when they have both houses, the legislature and the governor's mansion, they can do what they want. But if there's just one in there, then they have to negotiate, and a lot of that stuff starts to go away. Not totally, of course. I mean, as we see here in the state of New York, the Republicans have had the state Senate for a very long time. And we certainly have gerrymandered districts here that are very, very strange looking, if you look on the map. But we'll see if we can do something about that. But we're not as bad as some states. Some states are like North Carolina and some of the other states that had just districts shaped like spiders or, you know, twigs, and it's just bizarre looking maps. They're no relationship to community lines or to geography or anything, or local down ballot jurisdictions, nothing. Just very bizarre sort of looking maps that were drawn by computers, basically.
Well, you know, today is the vote, and the election is in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So
we got a month.
We talked about you coming back after the election to talk about the everything turned out, and if you think there was hacking going on. So, you know, in the final moments, do you have anything that you want to add to this conversation?
Well, I think one of the big questions is why people do this, and this is a big theme in my story, New York Station, is that, you know, I think a lot of conservative thinking is just driven by a belief that life is a zero-sum game. And one of my characters has a quote that came directly from George W. Bush. He said that Bush said, if I'm not winning, I just change the rules so that I do. Well, democracy is really impossible if people really feel that way. Everyone has to play by the rules for the system to work. But I think we're seeing this like with the Kavanaugh nomination, and a lot of things are going on. They're just bending the rules and changing the rules and breaking the rules and breaking the traditions of the Senate and doing all these things. And if you start to think it's a zero sum game, it's a very, and we're not all this in together. This is the key thing. It's a belief that we're not all this in together, and that one man's gain is someone has to be someone else's loss. That you know, we all lose in the end with that kind of thinking. It's like the idea of an eye for an eye. Well, as Gandhi said, we all wind up blind, and we have to work together as a society. And that's really the main thing that's broken down, I think. And a lot of New York Station is about that. It's not exactly procedural about rigging the election, but it's about why people would do that. So I think that's a key question in the whole thing.
Okay, so after the election, we'll talk again.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Larry Dudley, and this is Focus on Albany. And if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany. Larry, thank you, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm.